podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
All right, the Reds, it is the weekend. The footy's back, but not as we know it. And after 100 days without Premier League football, the longest break from top-flight football since the wartime, we have got something back. It is not the football that we know, as I say. But me, Gareth Roberts, I've got Rob Gutman, Ian Salmon and Melissa Reddy with me to talk about what they thought of the football being back. And also, of course, later to talk about playing the Blues at Goodison Park on Sunday evening. We've also got Grant Wall with Neil Atkinson. We've got some other bits and bobs coming up as well. It's a packed show. But first of all, let's talk about what we saw yesterday. Those two Premier League games, those two games played, which now means everyone is on 29 games played. Lots of stuff to get into, really. Everyone can sort of go where they want with it. But basically, we saw drink breaks. We saw more substitutions. We saw a big telly with fans' faces on where the crowd should have been. Very significantly, we saw players and officials taking the knee. We saw a goal line incident at Villa Park where Hawkeye occlusion, which was a great word used in their statement, that they said hadn't happened in 9,000 matches, happened and denied Sheffield United a goal and potentially a victory. And then we saw David Luiz be David Luiz and Man City easily claim victory against Arsenal, which means that Liverpool now can't win the league at Goodison Park and still require 6 more points. Rob, I'll start with you. You look eager to go. What did you make of the seeing the action again in the Premier League yesterday?
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I did. I enjoyed it a lot. In as much as, but you quickly slip back in and you sort of, I watched both games end to end, and you sort of forget you've ever been away soon enough. I wasn't distracted for long by the fact that it wasn't in front of fans or all the bullshit around that. And the football itself was interesting. I mean, obviously, the thing that stays with you is that what happened at Villa Park with the referee and the occlusion. Second new word I've learned since this pandemic, along with furlough. But it was very, very odd. I can't get my head around it, really. I think it's akin to something, I'm not sure what, where it means that game should be played again, in my opinion. I don't think that's okay. I think there's refereeing, even VAR is subjective, because ultimately a human being gets to go, I've taken, weighed up the evidence of VAR, and this is my decision. But that's kind of absolute, that. It's, you know, yeah. Hawkeye, I think it's not like we're meant to be playing the percentages. It either works or we don't have football matches where it's there. And I think there's a strong case. I'm not sure what other sort of precedent I'd compare it to. Like if you found out there'd been the ref had been bribed or something bizarre had happened. Or I actually think there's a case for that being played again. Because that wasn't, it should have been a goal. It was a goal. It was factually a goal. But for some mad aberration. You might as well say, oh, the scoreboard didn't record it as a goal. So it's not a goal. Soz. You know, the technology, what are we going to do? It still says 0-0 on the scoreboard. But it's bullshit. It's not true. That was a goal. So I can't really get past it. I don't know what everybody else did, but I did it with the crowd noise on the whole two games, and it was good. It was absolutely fine. I don't understand why you'd want it without. It sounds echoey and shit. I liked how the clubs are sort of making an effort to sort of decorate the empty seats. I'm looking forward to seeing what we've done what we'll have done with Anfield. Comparing it to the Bundesliga, it's night and day simply because we give a fuck, you know, and that's, who knew that was the key aspect. They say football's nothing without fans. Football's nothing unless you give a fuck about it. That is my big thing. I actually noticed in watching Liverpool Blackburn on the highlights on LFC TV the other week, you know, in the warm-up game Liverpool played, from having watched the Bundesliga and not being able to engage, so suddenly seeing Liverpool shirts, Liverpool players, you know, attacking, playing great football. I didn't give a damn that it was in front of no fans, quite frankly. Obviously, we want fans back, but football that's meaningful is football that's meaningful.
Yeah, I felt similar, I've got to say, in terms of, you know, just seeing faces that are new, players that are new, even the referee. You know, it's the first time I've ever been delighted to see Michael Oliver and his mad lockdown haircut. But Melissa, if you're still there... What did you make of the Premier League restarting You've now unmuted yourself, which I'm glad because I was worried there. What have you made of it all?
It was obviously, I have a dual interest, not just as a football fan, but somebody that has to cover the game on a daily basis. And during lockdown, it was obviously exponentially hard, as you guys will have felt yourselves, to generate content. Obviously, you can do in-depth stuff, but we're all emotionally involved with the game itself and what happens on the pitch. So when that's taken away, even if you're producing content, that it still feels like so much is missing, because you're not getting that emotional pull, you're not absorbed in it as much. And when the Bundesliga came back, that was a pivotal step, not only in having football to talk about, but also I think acclimatizing to the new normal. So you watch there how players arrived, how they walked onto the pitch, the sanitation measures, the water breaks, all that kind of stuff, not having the fans in, obviously listening to the echoes and listening to the manufactured crowd noise. I think it made the switch to looking at the Premier League, not as we know it, much easier. Because I think if the Premier League came back first, you'd have so much noise over how this is not football and, you know, this should have never come back. But with the Bundesliga, it's basically made it okay and all right that it is in this form. In terms of the football itself, I thought it was very interesting that every manager mentioned tempo, that they expected it to be higher, that there was a slow ease into the game, that they had to deal with the conditions in terms of the lack of atmosphere, in terms of it not being what players are used to generally. I thought that we saw technical teams, which has been the case in the Bundesliga as well, adjust better, or technical players especially adjust better. Absolutely unsurprising that Manchester City played as well as they did and were so dominant against an Arsenal that lost two players quite quickly due to injury and had David Luiz, who incredibly, in the most uncertain of times, still is able to do the most predictably David Luiz thing with the Hawkeye. It was astounding, because I think everyone looking, first viewing, it was obvious that it was a goal. And when the referee's watch doesn't go off, you're all thinking, were my eyes deceiving me? Because the level of trust in goal line technology has been huge, because we've not seen it, you know, make a mistake before. And when I think Sky showed the replays within 30 seconds, and you're thinking, whoa, it's most certainly, you know, my eyes are not deceiving me, definitely a goal. And you're expecting VAR at some point to intervene. And because it doesn't, it shows you as well the level of trust in the goal line technology, because the referee just automatically went with its decision, as did the VAR. The explanation was just mind-boggling. I think Chris Wilder said afterwards as well, fine, okay, there was a glitch in the technology, but why didn't VAR step in? And it's a game that had so many permutations, you know. Villa could stay up based on that point they got. Sheffield United could miss out on Europe based on not being awarded that goal and getting maximum points. So Barclays is back.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing that they've managed to serve up a huge piece of controversy in day one of its return. This is one of the reasons we love it, let's all be honest, because it gives us something to talk about. Ian, what were your initial impressions of it all? What were your takeaways from it all?
Well, the game itself, I dipped into the Bundesliga when it first came back. And yeah, it's a fake impression, because I don't watch Bundesliga. So yeah. I did have the whole thing of, I really don't give a shit about what's happening here anyway, because it doesn't impact me. But I was looking at it going, it all felt a bit slower. I couldn't tell, without crowd reaction, I couldn't tell whether a ball was a good ball or not. I couldn't tell whether people were playing well. But again, I didn't know what I was watching, because I don't follow Bundesliga. After watching a couple of games, and I realised that there is... sorry, I've got this weird noise going on in my ears, and I've got wind blowing in my ears, so I'm wearing headphones. After a couple of games, I realised that the pace was coming back. It was making a bit more sense. Obviously, if you watch Munich or Dortmund, then you start watching some decent football. And watching last night, because deliberately sitting down to watch the two, and I would never watch Villa versus Sheffield United. It's not a game I would have bothered with normally. But first game back, thought they did a cracking job on the ground. I think that whole idea of covering the bottom half with images of some kind makes it look a bit fuller. I watched it without the crowd noise because I found when you put the crowd noise on, that felt fake to me. I am kind of like, I'm used to playing FIFA. The crowd noise on FIFA is better than the crowd noise that was pumping in yesterday. So I'm watching it without the crowd noise. I've decided on that. The tempo, again, Villa Sheffield United didn't feel right, but City, you could see, it became a normal game of football for City. It became something where they could just play the normal game that they would play in front of a crowd that would dominate. On the Hawkeye thing, it's pathetic. What I'm about to say now might sound ludicrous, but I was under the impression the goal line technology had something to do with sensors, and they had some sensors on the post or something. And then they're talking about seven cameras. It's kind of like, oh, you've been using cameras all this time. You've not mentioned this before. It's also goal line technology, not cameras. And how occluded can a vision be? If I'm sitting in Bootle and I can see across the line, admittedly, I was half watching it. So first, like, well, that's a blatant foul. And Jeanette's like, that's his own player, that's the Villa keeper. Okay, yeah. But that could cost Sheffield United a shot of the Champions League. That could cost me a huge amount of money, could change the course of the club going forward. And there was some great news came up before that they may have grounds for a legal claim on it. So it could become very interesting from here on.
That's why I think it should be replayed. I think it's the most unique thing that's happened in the history of the frigging game in terms of a distortion. I think it's so unique that there's a case for the great game to be played again. But
I think what will happen is that everyone involved will be praying now that it doesn't come down to the matter of a couple of points in either of those issues that you mentioned, Ian. On the crowd noise, I found it oddly comforting in that, like, I obviously knew it was black, and I found some of it amusing. You know, we just had this vision of someone pressing buttons. There was one shot which was like ridiculously into the side net, and so into the side net, and you could hit it as soon as he hit it. And then the crowd noise was like, oh, and I was like, no one would have done that in the ground.
I was saying, me and my lad Rafi were arguing about it. I said, apart from like at Anfield, when the cop, the ball's at the other end of the pitch and the cop go mad because someone's gone into the side netting. I actually thought that was actually realistically so shit, it was realistic.
Well, on the crowds, because this is something inevitably as a podcaster and website and video channel and everything else that the Anfield app is these days that is run by football fans, inevitably we talk about the football fan aspect. And Rob, I'll come to you on this. There is talk straight away very quickly, almost a sea change really from the other week. They were saying it could be next year until we're back in grounds. So really, really quickly, Mark, the FA chief executive, Mark Bullingham, also, you know, figures within the government as well, now saying that they are having conversations, which may mean supporters may be able to watch matches as early as September. There's talk of digital passports via an app that would show people aren't infected and they would therefore would be allowed in. And also as well, I don't know if everyone's seen this because you probably just need to follow certain social accounts to see it. It's not really been in the news as such, but the Premier League has been speaking to fans groups about how they could make a sort of staggered return happen, which again is obviously very interesting. I mean, the problem is that under this 2 meter social distancing rule, which I'm sure you're very au fait with, Rob, being a man that runs bars. You know, in football grounds, it would mean around only 15% of the stadium capacity. If it was reduced to 1 meter, it could be more like 50%. But in either scenario, Rob, I mean, you think about Liverpool and Anfield and all the fury that there is every time around tickets and how they're doled out and who goes and who doesn't and all the rest of it. How the hell are they going to administer 15% of fans going back or 50% of fans going back? It's going to be an absolute nightmare, that one.
I've already discussed this with people. I mean, the obvious thing is to say, well, do you let season ticket holders in? I mean, it's an obvious thing I'm going to say because I'm a season ticket holder. But then it would as you rightly assert, it quickly cause outrage. People go, well, fucking hell, they have enough privileges. Why are they the first in the queue? So you could have that. I mean, you get to the ludicrous situation. I think we'd all rather it was all of us or none of us. Do you know what I mean? I almost think that probably is how it has to be. Mass gatherings feel to me like the most sort of, like I'm no epidemiologist, as you have to caveat all opinions you have on these things with. But the thing that's got the most publicity about being the most, the thing that's caused the virus to spread most has been mass gatherings. There's been investigations already into effects of the Cheltenham Festival, of Liverpool versus Atletico. So if this is the thing that was deemed in this pandemic to have been the most dangerous in terms of spreading a deadly virus, then this is something which I don't think they toy with. Don't get me wrong. I'm the sort of person who goes, please just fucking let me in a football ground. I don't want to think about the risks or anything like that. Especially with football's concerned, innately irresponsible. But I have to say, the logic says to me, they've got to feel it's so safe, spreading a virus wise, that it's safe enough for all of us to go in or none. This halfway house thing feels like game playing to me. I don't know. Yeah, I know you can mitigate through the distancing, but it feels a bit gameplay to me.
Melissa, what are your thoughts on it? Because obviously, as you mentioned before, you are working in a bit of a different world to some of us in that, you know, you are the dreaded mainstream media journalist that we so often wag fingers at. Mel, what have you made of this idea about, you know, there has been a sudden change, it seems to me, in discussion around getting fans back in the stadium. Maybe they've looked at it and gone, actually, it's very crap without them.
I think it's all because when you look at everything else that's happening around society, so if you're going to be going to the, clothing shops again, pubs, hotels, if people are going to be gathering in general at venues across the country, they're going to be watching football at pubs in their thousands and such, then it makes sense to investigate how to get fans back into the stadium, not only because, you know, football is that shared experience together. Match day income is vital for the survival of football clubs, maybe not Premier League clubs, but definitely lower down the pyramid. And with other leagues leading the way in terms of doing their due diligence of how they can stagger fans into the stadium, with the company doing the testing for the Premier League, saying that, you know, you'd be able to give health passports to fans and it can be monitored in that way, to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. There's a lot of information, I would say, that's out there about how to make it work in a safe and desirable way. I think the issue comes around if you're staggering fans in. So if you're saying only 30% of the stadium can be filled, for example, how are those 30% of fans decided? Invariably, people are going to be pissed off. So I think there's two elements. There's obviously the health element, which, like I say, there's a lot of information and stuff out there about how that can come about. And then there is the how do you actually implement it? And I think that's the very difficult thing to get done, because you're going to have a lot of pissed off fans.
And I just wanted to go to you on a slightly different point, because I feel we've covered that one. One other little thing I spotted before we go to the features that make up Weekender is I've been banging on about this, and maybe it's just me, it wouldn't be the first time, but I've been banging on about, you know, how fans are perceived again by the media, by the police, by wider society. You know, the fact that we're still governed by laws that were dreamed up in the 80s and things like that. You know, you can't have a bevy at the match, you can't have a bevy in the sights of the football pitch, you can't have a bevy if you're travelling to an away game, all those archaic rules. But, you know, beyond the police and beyond the government and beyond rules that are in place, you've also got the media. And I didn't want to throw this one at Mel because it would have been unfair, but I've felt all along, and I've written in the last couple of weeks, that I will always say it's some media, some journalists, some sections of all of those people, because they are lots of people and they are lots of organisations. But something that rang a little bit of an alarm bell for me today was I was reading articles in the Times about, you know, the football coming back and all the rest of it. And one of the pieces was they'd obviously had a bit of a stroll around Man City's ground to see who was there and to see what they were doing and to see what they were up to. And it was fairly, you know, it was like a couple of people had come down, gone the chippy, they'd interviewed them, and these people had said, well, it's sort of part of my routine. You know, I couldn't break my routine. I just sort of wanted to come down and have a look, and I'm going to go home now and watch it on the telly. And all that was, you know, all right, really. You know, it wasn't demonising anyone. It was just stating fact. But then there was this line in it, which is the one that's got up my nose, I've got to be honest with you, mate. It says, the majority, of course, stayed away last night. The novelty of watching their team live on TV proving rather more appealing than staring at a cordon of mass stewards. It could be a different story, of course, if the authorities do allow Liverpool to come here on July the 2nd. That fixture remains on a short list of high-risk games that could be moved to a neutral location. Now, that's Matt Lawton in the Times. I've already tweeted Matt to ask him, why could it be a different story? And why is that fixture remaining on a short list of high-risk games? Based on what? You know, what is it that authorities, media, police, whatever it may be, are seeing here that I'm not seeing? Because what I'm seeing, and maybe I'm a chippy scouser, but, you know, it feels like you're trying to say we're somehow different and we're somehow bound to misbehave in this situation.
It, of course, feels very loaded, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's that little comma, of course, comma. That's kind of, it looks like it's just there as a stopgap. No, it's loaded, and that's the point of the sentence. And it is, it just feels, I'm going to feel like a chippy scouser as well, because it feels like it's kind of, this is us. This is about us. It's the fact that you can't trust us to not get in a car and drive 28 miles to go and stand outside a large ground. You know, I've been the Etihad. It's no fun. I'm not talking about football. I've been the Etihad for gigs. Going to the Etihad is literally no fun at all. It's a hell of a stroll through the city centre. You're in a housing estate. It's, you know, I can get in my car now and be in Manchester in half an hour because I live at the end of the M57. I'm sorted. I could do that. I'm not going to. Who's going to do that? Why would people do that? So take the course off. The second thing of it is, we'll have won the league by then. All this is a case of just beating City on their own ground. That's just doing the job, and we can watch it on telly. So why drive 28 miles, or if you're in South Liverpool, that little bit further, to go and sit, go and look at a big concrete thing in the middle of the edge of the city and not be able to watch the game? It's pointless. So why, of course, why is it still high risk? But the one for me, it's down to us. This is down to us to be better than whatever they believe we are. We're better than that anyway. But this is down to us to be the best version of ourselves. On Sunday, when we play Everton, don't go anywhere near Goodison. There's no point going anywhere near Goodison. We're not going to win at Goodison anyway. But don't go near Goodison, because you do not get, and this again, this is not aimed at Mel's side of the media, aimed at the right-wing side of the mainstream media, because we know what papers we're talking about. Do not give them a story, because they are desperate for a story. And the story they want is that Scousers turned up to go to the match, and look at us, we're spreading the virus again. They're desperate for that story. Don't even give them a sniff of that story, because there's nothing to gain from going anywhere near Goodison. Let us beat Everton at Goodison. It's just another game. That's all it is. And it doesn't matter. Whoever you support, whether you're red or a blue, do not go near Goodison, because the Express, the Mail, the Telegraph, the Rag, they will all want that story. They're desperate for that story to happen. Don't give it to them.
Absolutely. Well said. Okay, well, the rest, we've got loads coming up in the weekend. We'll be back with this panel very shortly to talk about that game at Goodison Park and everything around that. But first off, we've got Grant Wall, some other features, and then we'll be back with us. So stay with us on the weekend.
Neil Atkinson and John Gibbons with James Sutton. And James is doing something pretty interesting this weekend. He's in conjunction with Standard Chartered, playing something called the Soundboard, the Stand Red Soundboard. He'll have special guests with him. And what it involves is effectively a YouTube Live that produces the crowd atmosphere that you get either in the ground or in pubs and bars, and puts it alongside the game as live. And occasionally has a chat in between in the quiet bits where not much is happening, and they're knocking it around centre midfield, which is also what happens at football matches, James. It's a bit of pressure, this, mate. I mean, you are effectively running the crowd for the Merseyside derby, and then possibly, if it all comes together, the game where Liverpool could become champions.
I wasn't nervous about it until about 3 seconds ago. When you put the enjoyment of Liverpool fans worldwide on my shoulders.
I think the players have got a bit more pressure than you. I'm just throwing that out there. You know, I mean, they've got to play well. I mean, what are you going to... It's going to be terrible. This is to get done for nothing, and you're just sort of sat there going, oh, well, we'll play a Sag, you'll never walk alone at the end. But that's not going to happen, James. They are going to beat Everton. Don't worry, you're going to get out of ball with them.
It's never even entered my head that we might lose any of these games. This is the worst chat I've ever... I could have possibly had. You've put the fear of God in me now, Neil. Now, do you know what? It's going to be absolutely brilliant. Because, you know, atmosphere and songs and chants are hugely important. You can't underplay the importance of that for anyone watching football. And I think we take it for granted. And if football fans and football as a whole has learned anything over the COVID-19, it's the importance of atmosphere and the importance of fans and voices. It's part of everything, from when you go to the pub, from when you go to the pie shop, from when you get in your seat, from when the concourse. It's about voices and about trying to create that atmosphere. So yes, I'm really hyped about it. We're all really hyped about it. It's going to be fantastic, assuming we don't lose.
Don't worry, we're not going to lose, James. We'll have a little chat about the game in a minute or two, but we're not going to lose, John. It is going to be, you know, you and I think have been to the last couple of Merseyside derbies at Goodison. I know you get to it almost every season. And then obviously at Anfield as well. It is going to be strange not to be there. I think it is worth us all sort of acknowledging that. It's going to be strange for people who live all over the world, who have the supporters clubs, the bars, the pubs they usually go to for the match, wherever they're based. It is going to be, I think, you know, it is going to be an odd thing. And I think anything like this, which pulls people in and reminds them of the togetherness of the enterprise, is very much a good thing.
Yeah, it is. It's a step into the unknown, isn't it, for everyone? And everyone's, you know, thinking about different ways to sort of make it feel more normal, if you like. And obviously these TV companies will have their own ideas, and, you know, I'm sure the football clubs are planning little things as well and looking at what's going on in Germany. And then there's obviously stuff like this that people like Standard Chartered have come up with. And I think people will find the way that suits them. And so there's obviously going to be different options out there. There'll be different things that we're doing. There'll be different things that people will be doing amongst themselves, and obviously that the broadcasts will be doing as well. And I think it's about finding the way that suits you. So, for example, you know, for the German stuff, some people have liked the crowd noise type thing. For some people, that, you know, it hasn't sort of been for them. I think it's making it work. And look, it is different. It is, you know, it's football, but kind of not quite as we know it. But it is the players back on the pitch. We all are all excited. And I think whatever can be done to make it work for you and make it right for you, then brilliant. So this is just another initiative for me of something that people are doing to make it more fun, to make it more exciting, and to make it a bit more communal as well. And JS on the decks, man. Wheels of steel.
Just in terms of making it more communal, James, you know, on the soundboard, people will be able to send their comments to you, to the operators, to request stuff or just interact with one another, just have a bit of a chat, obviously saying, you know, we want Liverpool to win and all that, but a bit of back and forth, because I think that's the other thing that, you know, when we watch football, we undertake a constant conversation with whoever the people are around us. And I think you can miss that and you can forget that, really. You can think you're not talking, but trust me, speak to any loved one who doesn't love football as much as you do, and they will let you know that you are constantly communicating while you're watching a football match. And I think you'll be able to do that. You'll be able to act as a hub for that. And that's also got to be pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's bringing people together. You know, I mean, it's such a cool thing. I'm gonna have all the different, all the songs that and Fields of Anfield Road through to Virgil van Dijk's song, through, you know, all the tunes that people want to hear,
all the hits,
all the big ones, all the hits. And yeah, it's gonna be fantastic, because every you know, it's gonna give a sense. It's a sense of togetherness. That's the biggest thing, and that's what we miss. Because football, sport, is a sociable thing. It is. I mean, I've realised in this pandemic, or certainly I've realised without football, I'm really boring. Like, I have nothing else to talk about apart from football. Thank God it's back. But that's exactly what it's about. It's about chatting to the guy next to you. It's about communicating. It's about chatting with the guy on Twitter or on social media. That's what it's about. It's about having opinions, voicing them, and singing songs and being part of something. You know, you can be anywhere in the world, but you hear that song and you join in with that chant and you're there. You're part of it. You're as important as the guy, you know, that with the season ticket. You absolutely are.
Is there anything that you're going to batter? Like, are people going to be sick of the field of Anfield Road? Are you going to be there absolutely right up the front field of Anfield Road all the way through?
Well, there's sort of an unspoken order of things, aren't there, at Anfield? When you go around, there's an order of service almost. I'm going to do my best to adhere to it. Obviously, we're going to start off with You Never Walk Alone, swiftly move into Fields of Anfield Road. Poor Scouser Tommy's going to get an airing, I would imagine, at some point. It's probably going to tailor off because people...
Yeah, maybe quiet and a bit in and out towards the end.
Yeah. You'll get the rush scored 4, 5, 6 and 7 chance. Apart from that, not a huge amount else. I'm just really, really excited about it, man. Just, I can't wait to get started. I never thought in my wildest dreams that the season when we will win the league, I will have a job be as part of some sort of mad DJ stadium announcer hybrid thing. It's fantastic.
Well, it is youtube.com/standardchartered to get involved. There'll be a set start time around that. You'll get, if you subscribe to that, you'll be able to see when it begins and go from there. It'll be there for every game, for all 9 of the games that are remaining. So most definitely check it out at some stage of proceedings, because you can see, and as John said before, if it's for you, if it adds to our enjoyment, and I think it will add to a great deal of enjoyment for a large number of Liverpool supporters all over the world. It will be triggered by events, so that matters. Obviously, play it alongside the game and feel as though you're part of it, as on-field events occur. So it is the Stand Red soundboard. It is with Standard Chartered. If you go to youtube.com/standardchartered, me, James, Mo and Amelia have had a little bit of a chat. There's a video on there as well. Check all that out. In the meantime, let's get back over with the show. Joined by Grant Wall, formerly of Sports Illustrated, now out on his own. And he has a podcast that we're going to talk about. He's doing some fantastic stuff with it and got some really good guests. It's called Football with Grant. But in general, Grant, the time that's been spent whilst there hasn't been games, and of course we're moving towards the big weekend where Premier League football returns. I know your podcast covers much of the world of football, but it's, I think, allowed people to take stock a tiny little bit. It's allowed some people to have a little look at what they're doing and what they're about, and you've got some pretty cool interviews as well.
Yeah, you know, it's been a lot of fun. It's great to see you, by the way. You know, it's been a lot of fun getting my work going again. You know, it's a weird media environment, especially during the pandemic. That's accelerated a lot of issues with the media. Sports Illustrated had new owners. They aren't great for Sports Illustrated. And a lot of the people who represented quality are no longer there. I'm no longer there after 24 years. But it's been a lot of fun to get the next chapter for me started. And while, you know, most media outlets aren't hiring right now, once sports get going again here in the U.S., I'm looking forward to getting a full-time job somewhere nationally. But for now, I wanted to start a podcast to just kind of stay out there. And I knew I thought I could get good guests. I knew I could in the United States. I developed a lot of relationships over 23 years in Europe as well. And, you know, to get Jurgen Klopp to come on my podcast on Monday this week and talk for around 20 minutes was great. You know, I did a big story on him for Sports Illustrated came out in January, but I was there in October, spoke to you for that.
Yep.
And I'm just so impressed with how he's handled sort of obviously the football side, but sort of the statesman side in talking about how we've all dealt with the virus. This is a global situation. He hopes we learn from it and get some positives out of it eventually. But also we talked about Black Lives Matter. He mentioned his son took part in protests in Berlin, which I hadn't known. Mm. And then we talked football, you know, and just about what this situation is like right now. He didn't want to jinx, you know, the title, but it's, and I understand that, but it could happen fairly soon here. depending on results. I know we're coming out on Friday.
Yeah. Well, no, just on the pause and that sort of, you mentioned the Statesman thing there. You mentioned, you know, you mentioned the Black Lives Matter work as well. For me, for the sports people, what I've been most intrigued by and what I keep talking about is sports people on the whole, their lives are scheduled way beyond belief. We have a running joke at the Anfield Rap that whenever we get a footballer to come in and do something, they will turn up early, probably definitely on time, but probably early. Jamie Carragher is always early. And the reason why is because sports people's lives is based around you turn up on time, you do the things that you're meant to do, you go through your training, you go through your regime, you go home, you rest, you relax, the next day starts again. Here's game day. Game day is structured. That's a rest day. On a rest day, you rest. And even if you look at close season, you rest. That's what you do in all sports, all professional sports, all elite sports. That's your rest period. And then we come back and we train. And what I think has been really interesting is this is the first time, I think, in a lot of these young people's lives where actually it's not being prescribed rest period. It's not being, this is your downtime because there'll be a lot of busy time to come. And I think you've seen so many of these young sports people show how socially engaged they are, not least because there's the room to be engaged in these issues. And we're having this conversation on the day that Marcus Rashford has got his result with the government on school meals. And to me, this is a really good example of sports people who you've been dealing with your whole life, who you know are intelligent, are switched on, are smart, suddenly getting the room to be able to display that because there's the time.
Yeah, and players in their early 20s, young players are finding their voice socially. So Marcus Rashford is 22. Some American national team players in Germany, Weston McKennie's 21, Tyler Adams is 20, you know, like stuff like that. I mean, like, that's really exciting to see, to see young players finding their social voice and using this time that they've had. And obviously they've taken time to stay fit and do the things they need to do, but they have had more time on their hands. And I am all for, not sticking to sports, right? Yes. And so that's the phrase you hear so often here in from a certain section of the American population. And now there's, I think, a majority of the population here that is saying, no. I mean, like, you know, we need our athletes to use their platforms in a very socially conscious way and do good things, whether it's Marcus Rashford, whether it's Colin Kaepernick. It's been fascinating here over the last month, and obviously the racism and police brutality against Black Americans is a decade, centuries long situation that is awful, but to see some real change starting to happen here, and for sporting organizations, whether it's the NFL apologizing for how they treated Colin Kaepernick and taking a knee during our national anthem, whether it's the U.S. Soccer Federation changing its rule, preventing players from kneeling during the national anthem, apologizing as well. This is stuff that I wouldn't have necessarily imagined even 2 months ago.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're living in a really important time, and I'm glad that athletes are being a part of it.
The podcast you do, your voice within American sports writing for soccer over a long period of time is fascinating to me. There's something that I find, and I think there's so much that doesn't translate between across the Atlantic. But one thing that I think doesn't translate across the Atlantic is how territorial sports are within the United States. This is in a pre-soccer era. So the idea is that, you know, there's a lot of conversation around the business of sport in the US and which sport is the biggest, which one's the most representative, at times which one is the most American. That sort of language is used between hockey, between NFL, between basketball, between baseball, that this is an ongoing thing. And I think that's so when on a European side, we dip our toe into this or find out bits of this. We're like, hang on, this is really, really strange. Is this just a soccer thing? But it isn't. And you've been sort of a very soccer orientated voice within American sports writing for a long period. And I think that's quite fascinating in a way that we don't understand or can't quite see the politics of that. That is actually almost in and of itself taking a position.
It is. You know, I started as a professional journalist in 1996 and was covering soccer from the start, but there wasn't enough demand from my editors to cover it full time. So I was covering basketball for quite a while with soccer on the side and always pushing to try and get more soccer coverage. And slowly that changed over the years to the point where finally in 2009, I was able to go full-time soccer. And part of that was due to my work in the years before that, but a lot of that was due to American television finally putting soccer, European soccer, Mexican soccer, soccer from the entire world on the television and turning the World Cup. And this sounds crazy to people over there. The World Cup, the men's World Cup, was not treated as a truly global, gigantic event in the United States, really on television until 2010. Now, 94 was different because that was, we were hosting it. Mm-hmm. But it really took that long. And ESPN was the group that put the 2010 World Cup, really, they treated it the right way. And only since then has club soccer truly followed. I mean, like, the United States has gone from being literally one of the worst countries in the world to watch football in on television to one of the best. And that's happened in a fairly short amount of time. So it is still different over here. I still feel like a business writer sometimes with the way I cover the sport of soccer, football. I mean, like, because there's so much about the business side and the expansion of MLS. Like, here's an example. I'm producing a series right now on Freddie Adu, like that whole phenomenon. It's going to be a podcast series. And that was 2004 when Freddie Adu, at the age of 14, was the highest paid player in MLS. Crazy. And yeah. I remember covering it. And there were only 10 teams in MLS at that point. This year, there are 26 teams in MLS. And in 2 years, there will be 30 teams in MLS. And part of me is worried that they're expanding too quickly, like the NASL in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
But, you know, like that's also a business story, to the point where sometimes my thing is I just want to cover the soccer more, you know, and you try to find the right balance. But soccer's still very much, it is an American thing too, I think, because even the other sports in the U.S. talk about business a lot more than I think you'll see the coverage where you are.
As part of that, it's fascinating to me, and I'm sorry to now push back on you and ask you the business conversation. I might end this and ask you your favorite player is, and we can have a chat about that. But yeah, I'm fascinated that, as we're talking, news has come out that the MLS is returning earlier than I think a lot of other American sports, that July the 8th, the MLS will be on screens. The Premier League obviously is on screens over in the United States, and there's an argument that the time difference, the fact that a lot of these games are taking place now in evenings across this period, may well also place it in a different place in the American television schedule. That ultimately, all of a sudden, and it's obviously not planned, but there is actually an opportunity for soccer in the United States to grab a fair bit of attention between Bundesliga, La Liga, Premier League, and then the MLS returning in July.
I think it's a great opportunity for the sport of football in the United States right now, because you're not really seeing any other U.S. pro sports league starting up again until late July when the NBA gets going. And so from now until the end of July, it's basically all soccer if you're interested in live sports in the U.S. And I've run into gamblers who, you know, they're not professional gamblers, but they're like, look, I need live sports. And so they're getting into the Bundesliga for the first time. They're going to get into MLS in the Premier League for the first time. Some of them already are doing it. And so I do think this is an opportunity for the sport and whoever can, you know, just get so many games out there, like the women's league, the NWSL is actually the very first.
It's going a week earlier, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So at end of June. And so I think if they do things right, it's going to be a good opportunity to get new fans, potentially keep some of them. But, you know, like, I also don't want to get screwed up, right? I mean, the Bundesliga hasn't had any positive COVID tests.
Yeah.
And they've done a really good job as a whole in Germany. better than our countries have. And that's carried over to the Bundesliga starting earlier, and they've done a good job on keeping everyone healthy there. So I do have a worry.
Yeah.
So MLS is going to play a hub tournament in Orlando, Florida. In Florida right now, the cases are going up. Utah, where the Women's League is playing their hub tournament, cases are going up. And so you just want them to be safe.
Yeah.
And yet I do think it's good to have sports coming back as long as it is safe, because it's a bit of a, you know, it's a piece of humanity coming back. It's been fun for me to see Lionel Messi play again last week.
I'll come on to your favorite player in a minute. Just a little bit more on the podcast. You've chatted away to Jürgen. I think with the podcast, you do want it to be genuinely international in feel and spirit, because that's your outlook towards the game. Your outlook towards the game has never been, you know, for instance, your last book is full of, it goes to lots of different places, lots of different stories, lots of different ways in which the game interacts. There's an excellent sort of chapter that explains the very notion of what Pulisic was way before he was, you know, a Chelsea player. You want that, don't you, within the podcast? You're not looking to, in any way, shape, or form, be specific to a league. You want a broad outlook, and that's why when you speak to Jürgen Klopp, when I speak to Jürgen Klopp, I'm very Liverpool-focused. When you speak to Jürgen Klopp, you know, you can have him run all over the world and tell you a broad focus, a story.
Yeah, and I've enjoyed being that sort of different type of media. I think, I mean, you have to ask him, but I think he enjoys maybe talking about something a little different. Like we have some overlap.
But
I think, you know, like he asked where I was coming from. And I said, New York City. Our producer was coming in from Miami. He wanted to know what was going on in New York. We talked about The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan, Chicago Bulls thing that he saw, because he had the time to see it. And in that part, I've always sort of enjoyed over the years where, you know, like I'm not there day to day. And so if I can get an interview set up with Klopp or Jose Mourinho or whomever, it's out of the ordinary for them. And maybe they actually, I hope, kind of enjoy it a little bit, even though it's just, it's still part of their obligations. But that part's been fun, you know? I mean, like, and just the chance to ask Klopp, you know, the Bundesliga is forbidding hugging after, you know, after players score goals. You're the most widely known hugger in
professional sports.
What are you going to do, man? You know? And he got this look on his face of like, I don't know, you know? Like, I think he's actually going to have to think about it. I hate the idea of a muted Jürgen Klopp.
It doesn't seem right or proper. Where can people find the podcast?
It's Football with Grant Wall. It's wherever you get your podcast. It's Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Android. It's out there. Like, we've had a really good cross-section of guests. You know, about half of them I try to be American. So we've had Tyler Adams, mm-hmm. RB Leipzig. We've had Landon Donovan on. You know, we had the Women's League commissioner on, but also we've had Roberto Martinez, the Belgium coach, who was in my book, had a chapter there. Yeah, we had Jürgen Klopp. We even had Henrik Mkhitaryan last week, who's a really interesting guy, and I had never interviewed him before, speaks six languages, really thoughtful. And there's so many people like that in the sport. I don't know how many of my audience or my listeners were like, oh, I hope we have a Henrik Mkhitaryan interview at some point. But once they actually heard him, they were like, oh, yeah, this guy's really interesting. And I love providing that opportunity to my listeners. The one thing that's a challenge though, Neil, is I thought about having two different podcasts. That one would be sort of an American-focused soccer podcast, and the other would focus mostly on European guests, because I do think, and I may do this at some point, because I come out with two episodes a week, Mondays and Thursdays. They're always interview-based. And I do think the European audience, which I'd love to get more of, obviously, is less interested in half-American interviews.
I think that might be true.
But at the same time, I mean, you always have the option of whether you want to listen to an episode or not, and you're going to get, you know, hopefully half people that are over in Europe.
Yeah, make them work for it. That's my attitude. It's always been my attitude. Let them self-select. It's fine. I'm very in for that. And who's your favorite player? I promised you.
Who's my favorite player? I'm a Messi guy. I'm very much...
He's the best one.
My roots are in Argentina. I lived there at one point. My first game that I saw in Argentina was Boca Juniors at Rosario Central in 1994. And Lionel Messi, I'd like to imagine, who grew up in Rosario, like, you know, five-year-old Lionel Messi was somewhere around that vicinity when I saw my first Argentine League game. Finally got to interview him in 2016. And actually had a much better experience interviewing him than most people who told me that he would be as an interview. He's never been the most enlightening character, but we did it in Spanish. And it was funny because we had a microphone malfunction for about 7 minutes, and his agents were freaking out. But Messi was okay with it, I think.
Yeah.
And so we ended up having this sort of random 7-minute conversation just about stuff. And he asked me where I was from and what soccer was like in Kansas City, where I'm from. And I ended up talking to him about the MLS team in Kansas City. And he was sort of humanized to me in a way that that I enjoyed. So that added to him being my favorite player.
Marvelous. Great stuff. Thank you very much, DeGrant. Beer 52, John. I've got my box. It has been delivered. I've got it sat there waiting to use it amongst a number of different hot mics. And there's every chance, John, there's a fighting chance, and this is not an exaggeration, that the first beer I have with Liverpool as champions could be one that comes from a Beer 52 box. And if you'd have said that to me 12 months ago, I'd have thought you were absolutely bananas, but we are where we are.
Yeah, it would have been a pint of lager or at least a bottle in some establishment around Anfield. But yeah, we're all going to be at home, and so this way of coming into it. But I'm glad you ordered. Did you go to beer52.com/wrap to get your first case of 8 beers for just $5.95, Neil?
I absolutely did, John, and you know why? Partially for the value, but also to put our numbers up. Say what you want, I'm exceptionally cynical in the department. And I would, and literally I'm about to recommend that anybody else goes to beer52.com/wrap to do exactly the same thing, because firstly you'll get the good stuff, but also it'll be another one in our column. In my head, we've got like a wall that's loads of tallies.
Yeah.
Not like it's not digital, this. Some fella shouts.
Yeah, another one for the map. Tick. Yeah. Take that, scientist. Yeah. We're very competitive in every possible way. Vote for the Anfield Wrap and the British Podcast Awards. Buy from our partners using our codes. Yeah, we just want to beat everyone, really. So is there a theme in what you've received? Because I know they love a theme at Beer 52.
I haven't opened it yet, to be honest. I've just put a sat there by the fridge. I'm saving it. Like, I literally don't want to open it because I'll have one and I'm trying to act disciplined. So I don't know what the theme is this time out. I mean, it'll be good. I say it'll be good. Again, I'm going to say this, like 7 of them, there's 8, or I get 10, you know, because I'm a bit posh and I got carried away. But you can get the 8. But if you get 8, you'll really like 5 of them. You'll be intrigued by 2, and there'll be one that you want nothing to do with. And that is absolutely fine. It's literally the way in which it's meant to work, isn't it?
Yeah, for me, that's normally the one that's approaching 8%. It just feels moody. You know what I mean? I'll go with 6.8, Neil. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'll say, well, that looks lively, but I'll do it. But anything that's approaching 8 or the number of the beast, you know, is just too far for me.
I'm always a bit like, is this wine? Have they given us wine on this one? Yeah, what on earth?
Where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line? But hey, there's some daredevils out there in our listener bases, and then Neil, do you know what I mean? He might be into it.
There absolutely are some daredevils out there. But this is, you know, I think the thing about it, the other person in ours who's excited about it is actually the only other person in ours, which is Samantha. But she is actually also, she's getting into a bit of the Beer 52 as well, which is really, really interesting. I'm very pleased about it. So she's getting stuck in as well and having a little look and picking out one or two she might fancy. So I'm
saying she's a big fan of her aesthetics as well, isn't she, Sam? And there's some beautiful artwork, I would say, with these cans when they come.
Absolutely.
I love them visually as much as a taste sensation.
Indeed, absolutely. So yeah, do check it all out. It is beer52.com/wrap. You get the first 8 for the $5.95, and then if you want to stay, if not, cancel. I mean, it's easy as anything to cancel. Beer 52 is the number 5 and the number 2 .com/wrap. You'll get within there the tasty snack, which again, sometimes not that tasty, let's be honest, but sometimes is delicious. There's the excellent magazine in there. And you'll do very, very well out of it. And I have legitimately signed up with my own money. They'd best still send the occasional one for free, John. I'm just throwing that out there because it's a real tonic for the troops when it comes.
Yeah, we'll let you know when the offices reopen, guys.
Yeah, yeah. The office reopening will be massive for a number of fronts like this. The people sending books to the office and everything, John, and then saying to me, "Have you got the book?" I'm like, "No, we're not in. I'm socially distanced from literature." Anyway, so you can get a fantastic case of the 8 craft beers that they source. They pull them together. You don't have to do the hard work. You do the easy bits of having the drink. Beer52.com/wrap. $5.95 for the postage. Get stuck in, and we can all share a beer 52 when Liverpool win number 19. Joined by Greg O'Keefe to have a chat about Everton before this Merseyside derby, which will be the strangest Merseyside derby at the weekend on Sunday. But before we get into the specifics of that game, Greg, the thing I noticed, I had a look at Everton's remaining fixtures, and bar possibly Southampton, Everton are in a bit of a, what's the kingmaker slash the opposite of kingmaker position. They play all three sides who are in the bottom three. After Liverpool, they play, I think they've got games against Leicester, against Sheffield United, against Wolves. They're basically, other than Southampton, Everton's remaining games are all with sides who very much got something to play for, but Everton themselves are probably just too far back from one and too far ahead of the other.
Yeah, I'd say that's a fair evaluation of where they're at. I mean, some Blues are talking about Europe, and in theory, they're only 6 points behind Wolves at the moment. But the way they were playing before lockdown, I wouldn't have thought. I would have felt that 6 points, felt more of a gap than it does on paper. Of course, the injuries since they've gone back to training has sort of compounded that. And then the nature of the fixtures, as you say, you know, Norwich, right down there fighting for it, it's going to be a tough game. And as you said, it's probably only really Southampton, Leicester. We've done poorly against recently anyway, and they've still got a lot to play for. The Derby's probably won the games, with, apart from Southampton, with the least at stake now, isn't it? In a sense, apart from obviously everything else. You know, talk about Kingmaker. I mean, Liverpool are going to be champions, but that's probably the one where it's like not going to have that much impact in the long run.
It is a strange thing, and it's a strange little setup. And you mentioned there the form just before lockdown. You know, I think we'd be having a very different conversation if lockdown had come three games earlier. And I think that's where it's, you know, from an Everton point of view, where it ends up just being a frustrating little period with that heavy defeat to Chelsea, frankly, and a really poor performance. The 1-1 draw with Manchester United, which could have been more, could have been better, and the 3-2 defeat against Arsenal. All three of them, if the results go even just a tiny little bit the other way, then I think, you know, Blues are in general bouncing back into this period thinking, well, let's see what we can do. Whereas as it is, you know, Carlo's had time with the players, etc., etc. Whereas as it is now, it does just seem like that mountain's just a little bit too high and there's too many teams to get past.
Yeah, spot on. That the game at Chelsea was such a hit for morale. Even after United, you know, sort of like with the last minute drama of the decision to deny the penalty on Sigurdsson and overall, the way they played, you know, sort of Carlo and Ancelotti going on the pitch and a bit of tub thumping and kind of galvanised the crowd. If you just cut it then, I think it would have been a very different mood. But then you got that one extra game where you're going down somewhere where you've not won since, I think, 97 in the league. And to play like that and to get completely overrun in midfield in such a... Look, it sounds melodramatic, but it genuinely was humiliating on the day. You've got like the boy Gilmore was just running circles around much more experienced midfielders. Then you had the added sort of like pathos of Tom Davis, who at one point you felt had the same buzz around him as Gilmore. He was just chasing shadows. And defensively, we didn't look very solid, which you kind of hope, you know, an Ancelotti team will be. Didn't really cause them any problems up the other end. And in many ways, given the background of Ancelotti at Stamford Bridge, you were thinking, is he going to turn it round? And then I suppose it puts in context how little time he's had so far with this group of players, how average the squad is, with a few exceptions, you know, a few really sort of outstanding exceptions and things like Richarlison.
Yeah.
Still remains a lot of dead wood, and, you know, there's a lot of work for Ancelotti and Marcel Brands to do to clear that out and to bring in, you know, the manager's own players. Who can, and it sounds like we're in this, trapped in this Sisyphean cycle as Evertonians going on. But next season, when this manager's had the chance to add this, but in fairness to Ancelotti, you can't really, I think me and you said it before, you can't really, this is a natural conclusion of this game, isn't it? Because you can't go better than that for Everton. Mm. There's no way. So we've got to believe that this manager, with his reputation and his acumen in the windows and his contacts, can finally get it right. And we can avoid days like that last game at Chelsea. I've gone off on a tangent there, but it really hurt as an Evertonian that game.
No, I can see that. And I think it is that sort of realisation where, because this is, you know, getting beat is one thing, but seeing a gulf is something that's quite different. And seeing a gulf of the side that occupies the position that you'd like to fill. You know, I don't think that there's, there's a lot of jokes about the way in which people support football teams across the board, but I don't think there's Evertonians sat around in all seriousness thinking we want to be 2 years away from being able to genuinely challenge for the league title. But it's perfectly reasonable to think we want to be 2 years away from finishing top four. So to go to the place of the side that finishes fourth, but have them demolish you and have 4-0 flatter you and not them, is obviously going to be a massive, massive kick in the teeth. And I think that, and in this run of games, there are a lot of players, aren't there, who may well actually in the end be playing for their Everton futures and who probably know that before this run of games starts. You know, you mentioned Tom Davies there, and he could end up being a pretty good example in that he's a local footballer who everyone's got a lot of fondness for. But you get the impression that when it gets through a couple of windows, Carlo Ancelotti is not going to be that bothered about whether or not Tom Davies comes from around the corner. He's going to want someone who can help him win football matches.
Yeah, spot on. I mean, it's been spoken about that he wants to add someone in central midfield. They've already got like an abundance of bodies there, but very little class. Obviously, Gomez, when he's fit, walks into... And I don't think it's necessarily always going to be a 4-4-2, but with the confines of a 4-4-2, which is what he's set up for, I think, this season, I'd be surprised if he tweaked it much between now and the end of the season in July. There's only really two slots, aren't there? So Gomez is definitely one of them. Obviously, they've had the step back with Cabana, who was thought of as someone who could come into the picture and play a lot. But Davies has got a chance now, I think, because Schneiderlin's injured and looks like he's going to be moved on in the summer. So it's an opportunity for Davies to show definitively what he is, what type of central midfielder he is. And you know what? We'll probably talk about it in a minute, but a good assumption without the fans could actually help Tom, because there's this thing with Everton and local lads, isn't it? There's so much desire and so.
Do you think that's legitimate, or do you think that's jokes from Reds?
No, I think it's legitimate. No, I mean, it's not as kind of binary as like everyone in Goodison gets on a local lad's back. That's not the case at all. You know, there's actually huge grounds for the Blues who are like willing to cut him slack and get really frustrated at the jeers and the catcalls, but they are there. The frustration is there. I remember watching Ross Barkley misplace passes and hearing like palpable groans and boos. And I remember watching Ross and knowing it was getting to him. Mm. Now, Tom Davies looks like quite a mentally resilient young man to me, but it's going to affect the player, especially a local lad. And maybe it might just be an opportunity for him to, and especially because he's used to that. He'll have played at Goodison a lot in the under-23s when there's not many there at all. So this could be an opportunity for him. And he'll know that on the bench is going to be like even younger central midfield prospects like Benny Beningame, Dennis Adeniran. And I believe Adeniran in particular has been flying in training, you know, got an eye for goal, a bit of a box-to-box central midfielder. So the stakes are high for Tom. He doesn't want anyone even younger kind of coming in and supplanting him. And if he's going to be in there in the long term, I think this is his opportunity to really show the manager what he can do.
Looking at the team then, what the likely side's going to be, another player who may be under a little bit more pressure than people might be surprised by is Pickford in goal. I think that there is a bit of a view from some Evertonians, Greg, that he's not had the best season, far from it, and didn't have a great season last season either. He's come in for some criticism. I'd say reasonable criticism. I don't think any of it's been unreasonable. I think when you look at his last couple of seasons, there's some spectacular saves and spectacular moments, but there's a lot of quite bemusing mistakes. There's a lot of 4 out of 10 stuff where lashed in alongside a lot of 10 out of 10 stuff at times.
Yeah, I think Jordan Pickford is probably not the biggest problem that this current squad, I spoke earlier about how it's quite an average squad in too many places for me at the moment to make any real progress. That's why there's still work to be done. And it's like daunting when you think how different the window will be, but you know, they've got to do it. I just don't think goalkeeper, despite, I agree with what you said there, for me, he's not the perfect solution to the goalkeeper. He's not reliable enough week in, week out, especially when the effect of his, what one of his major strings was, you know, his sort of distribution, those kind of fired balls down into the channels. We haven't really seen that being as effective this season. So the focus has been on more, can he do the basics consistently? And he's been found wanting in certain occasions. So people also, and I had this conversation with other Blues, and they say, yeah, but his age is a massive factor. He has been this good to a certain point at this age. He can only get better. Well, that's a nice optimistic take on it. I'm not sure. But I think for now, he's definitely going to remain. Like, I don't think goalkeeper's going to be a position they're going to address in the summer with any urgency, other than maybe someone to come in and push him. But I think Jonas Lossell's that at the moment, that option. So he's going to have to get better because he's going to cost you goals.
Looking at the side, I wonder, Baines was coming into a degree of form before the lockdown hit.
Yeah, he was.
Is there a chance he might go with basically almost play to be possibly right midfield with Coleman behind him and Dean left midfield with Baines behind him? Is that something that he might actually think about? Not simply because it's up against Liverpool, but because he's actually getting some of his better players on the pitch there. I know Sidibe had an absolute nightmare at Stamford Bridge, but he did seem to like him before the lockdown period.
Yeah, he did. And he did have a nightmare at Stamford Bridge, right? And to be honest, it doesn't feel like the answer as the sort of replacement for Seamus Coleman or someone to, you know, play a lot of games and keep Seamus on his toes. I'd like them to let Jibril go back to Monaco and find another option there. I could see it potentially happening on the right, having said that, where you've got Coleman and maybe with the injuries, you know, obviously Walcott's out, had surgery, might have Sidibe on the right of a midfield to give you that extra, well, I say solidity, but, you know, you saw the game at Stamford Bridge. But in theory, two more defensively minded right side players might help. I don't think he'll go for Dean and Baines, only because he's going to have a go. And if you don't play sort of one of like Bernard or maybe Anthony Gordon or someone who can kind of get in behind the lines, then you really are sort of saying to me that we're just going to set up. Not that we should expect to dominate the game against Liverpool, but I think you've got to have a little bit more of an attacking threat than that. But it's going to be interesting what he does. I mean, but you're right, Baines on form was looking better than Luca Dean. But Luca Dean's the younger man and has got the legs. That said, you know, Baines against United, at the end of the game, was like sprinting up and down that pitch to put in blocks and goal-saving challenges like a man 10 years younger. So we're going to have to see how they've all come through lockdown. But that could be a little tip there, mate. You might have hit on something because I know, speaking to people, his stats in terms of his fitness during lockdown, you know, the stats sports vests they all wear, which they feed in, his were comparable to a lot of elite athletes. I've chatted to someone who works at Stats Sports, and he said, like, hit Baines's sprints and recovery work and was up there with, like, you know, Anthony Watson, the England rugby winger, who's like 26 and is an absolute specimen of an athlete. So you never know. And Luca Dean had been off it a little bit, but we'll see. Personally, I think they'll have a bit more of an attacking intent down one of the wings.
The big three, Keane alums certainly play alongside Holgate because of Mina's injury. The big three, the three most impressive performers for Everton over the course of the season, Greg, and the three that Liverpool supporters should keep an eye on, but also which Liverpool themselves will keep an eye on, it's where the front two are concerned, are Calvert-Lewin, Richarlison, and Holgate. Those three, really, when you're talking about trying to build a side that can challenge for top four, those are the three you've got in mind to build around, aren't they? They are the three who have been the most impressive over the whole of the season and who look like they could play at the very highest level week in, week out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, going on there about Baines and his like physical prowess and how he's been professional during lockdown, I read a piece with Paul Joyce in the Times, and he was talking about, I think he'd spoken to David Unsworth, who'd said Calvert-Lewin's come back sort of even stronger and even more sort of like physically primed to have an impact or a continued impact So it's been a massive breakthrough season for Dom, and I think he's like thrived having a partner in Richarlison who makes so many clever runs and who's can be really selfless at times and complements his game in a sort of like a classic sort of front two way. So they're the major positive and Richarlison. What Calvert-Lewin is more of a goal, like a goal scorer. The problem in the past was that he looked like the goal scorer. He looked like a centre forward. He could do almost all of it, but then too often he couldn't finish chances consistently. He stepped that up a little bit this season. But Richarlison, for me, is just such a fantastic player. At his very best, there are echoes of, this to me would be like a huge compliment. There are echoes of Luis Suarez in the sheer will to win, that the kind of like street fighter, the ability to kind of do it all, good and near, two-footed, kind of have full-backs and defenders really on edge throughout the game. And he's got that talismanic sort of impact as well. He's slowly starting to stop with the theatrics and the rolling around every time he gets touched. But he does get a fair bit of treatment from defenders, and I think it's a testament to how far he's come on. And Holgate, again, I didn't see that transition into the player we've seen coming. If you asked me in sort of last September, I just thought he's not really got a career at Goodison, but he's really matured, and I believe off the pitch as well, he's really kind of grown up. Reading of the game is good. I speak to a few people who say he still gets a bit too emotional at moments and can get pulled into battles and lose his head in a way that, say, Van Dijk won't. Mm-hmm. Chance of Liverpool supporting mate, he was sort of comparing him to Lovren in a way, in that he's got a lot of qualities, but you can get pulled into those personal battles and then almost lose focus when it matters. But I think obviously with Holgate's age, there's a lot of potential there. And those three are definitely, as you say, what we're looking to build the side around next season, along with Andre Gomez in midfield.
I'm going to ask you this stupid question, and it's a stupid question for a variety of reasons, but not least because we've got no sense whatsoever how these players are going to play and how it's all going to come together on both sides. It's going to be a strange game, although there was, Villa versus Sheffield United in one sense sort of plays out not dissimilar to how you'd expect. City versus Arsenal plays out not dissimilar to how you'd expect. It would be it'll be a tough afternoon for Everton. Do you think they can get something?
I think there's a genuine relief that the stakes aren't as high as lose and Liverpool win the title.
Yeah.
From a Blue point of view, understandably, I suppose you can imagine that would have just been horrific, really. Go on, sorry.
No, I think that's perfectly reasonable. I mean, you wrote a piece about it right the way before all of this kicked off, when it looked as though it was looking like it might become possible as the games were rolling, and you were saying that there'll be nothing worse for Evertonians.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Like, of course they can in theory, but I just think with the injuries and it's going to be unlikely. I mean, you saw our Liverpool in. I know it was only a bounce game against Blackburn, but the signs are there's not many injuries, if any, are there?
No.
The signs are that it hasn't really dulled the sort of. And in fact, it might have helped Liverpool to break the 100 days off. The intensity with which they play. But then again, City, will it have played in? I mean, if Liverpool could go in there to win the title, I think I would have feared it more that we couldn't have got anything in the game, because without the fans, I think the psychological advantage would be with Liverpool, if you get me. Everton would try and raise themselves, but without that 12th man at Goodison, I think it would have been a mismatch. In terms of the quality of the teams, it is obviously a mismatch. So I'm going around in circles here, aren't I? I think we can get something, but I'm not holding my horses that we'll get much more than the points at best, to be honest.
Okay, thank you very much to Greg.
And it's John Gibbons and Neil Atkinson now for the Anfield Wrap to talk about a new partnership, and it's the football pools, which, Neil, I'm really excited about. I have fond memories of the pools growing up, and they're back.
Absolutely. I'm somewhat overwhelmed, to be quite honest with you, by us getting the football pools. I couldn't believe it when it came through, and it immediately, I mean, it managed to stroke memories of the Prudential in that sort of genre of things that involve people coming to the door when you were growing up. And that's what the football pools used to be. It's not what it is now. It's obviously, like so many things, quality football chat, it's moved online. And that's where you now get it from. But there is a lot to be said for the number of draws, for effectively crosses and twos and ones, and the sort of unbelievable hold this has on my imagination of sitting and listening to or watching the classified scores as they come in.
Yeah, I mean, as I used the word back, I mean that in the context of football being back. It's never gone away. It's 97 years now it's been going for in Liverpool as well. So a real sort of Liverpool institution, which I like. And my sort of memories of it, similar to you to Neil, is people coming to the door. But also I remember my mum and dad didn't play the pools, I don't think. But my friend Ben, his mum and dad did, and he used to be there a lot on the Fridays. And I just remember Ben's dad sort of slaving away over all the scores and looking at form and stuff like that and picking numbers. And then basically Ben's mum doing it very much as picking her favourite numbers and beating him every week. And it was an early indication to me as a young boy, Neil, about men who don't know as much about football as they think they do.
Yeah, I think you absolutely couldn't agree more. And simultaneously, the fact that ultimately, whilst there's a lot to be said for instance, the current Liverpool team winning 27 out of 29, loads and loads of this game is unbelievably random. Yeah. So let's be quite clear about this. You know, last night, you and I, we were talking whilst watching a football match wherein Sheffield United and Aston Villa played out a no-score draw, but mainly because loads of people decided that the ball never went over the line. And maybe, you know, the other side of that is that maybe if Sheffield United, the goal had been given, Aston Villa might have snagged an equaliser, and then it would have been a score draw. Yeah. And therefore it becomes something a little bit different. And it is, you know, it's an extreme example, but the football pools and everything that goes on around it is a reminder that there's a lot of football that is fundamentally just a bit random, and loads of people trying to deal with things that are a bit random to the best of their ability.
Yeah, and that's why the prizes are so big. It's £3 million, which is the jackpot this weekend. Yeah, £3 million quid. If you can correctly predict 9 score draws, now you get 10 goes, so you've got a little bit of wiggle room, but if you can nail 9, then the jackpot is £3 million quid. Obviously, there's other prizes available as well.
Is it from 49 games, John?
It's Saturday's games. Well, Saturday and Sunday, sorry. So forget about tonight. You've got until 12:55. Yeah. It's I'm just having a little look now. I've signed up before. Yeah, it's 49. Yeah. So
going across Europe, are they? Is that the plan?
Well, just let me get it up. I didn't know. Yes.
Yes. I've got it.
I apologize. Yeah. So it's 49 games, and we're going to Spain. We're going into Turkey here, which is exciting. A little bit of Italy as well. So it's across Europe. So you've basically got until Saturday 12:25. That's when the game closes to pick. And as I say, if you just fancy playing because you think it'll liven up the footy scores, then you can just press a lucky dip button, or you can pick your favourite numbers, or you can use a bit more skill and think Bournemouth Crystal Palace, that's got score draw written all over it. And then you click number two. And so that's you know, there's different ways to play and there's different ways to enjoy it, and it means no matter what your footy knowledge is, you can have fun. I've signed up. If you do subscribe through the link that we're going to save before, you can get 4 free games. So that's an extra little bit of incentive they've thrown through to people. So the link, if you do want to play, is footballpools.com/TAW. That's footballpools.com/TAW. Obviously, if you go through that link, it helps up and helps us and helps. It makes it more likely to keep the partnership going.
Yeah.
So we'd encourage you to have a look through that link, obviously, and we'd appreciate that very much as well. So footballpools.com/TAW. And as I say, if you subscribe, which I did earlier, then you get 4 free games, which isn't bad at all. But I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a real sort of trip down memory lane for me. And I'm going to have my coupon there with scores in front of me on Saturday. And I just can't wait to curse Barnsley.
Yeah, I'm sitting here looking at Civet versus Lugano, thinking could be something in that number 33. Could be something in that one. That would be absolutely terrific. Do try and play along if you can. It is very much meant to be fun. Do take it with fun in mind. That is what we're about, and it's really cool to be working with them. And the other thing about the football pools, John, is that it was always a Liverpool business. It's been a Liverpool business since the year dot.
No, absolutely. I've had real fun talking to them and reminiscing about it. There's one lady who I've learned about who's worked there for 53 years, which is just, you know, it's a crazy amount of time, but obviously she still loves it. And, you know, she's seeing the football pools in all its, you know, forms and all its sort of variations. But, you know, they are trying to sort of modernize, obviously, at the moment. They're doing, you know, a little bit with a new look, and that's sort of where we're coming in to help sort of promote that. So do have a little look. As Neil says, it's meant to be fun, it's sort of meant to be a laugh, but you know, he's written a lot of big checks over the years, and wouldn't it be lovely if an Anfield Rap subscriber was the next one?
Absolutely. Inter Milan Sampdoria, I'm not saying yes, I'm just saying things about it.
Okay, back with us now then, and back to talking about the football, which is back, including of course Everton v Liverpool at Goodison Park on Sunday night on my birthday. Come on, you Reds. Before all that, we've got Norwich v Southampton and Spurs v Man United is next tomorrow night. But the table's still looking pretty good, Rob. The Reds are 22 points clear at the top of the Premier League table, needing at a max 2 wins to clinch the title. There's some spectacular examples of heads falling off among Everton fans, which I've been greatly enjoying these last couple of days. One what got sent to me earlier this morning really made me laugh was what someone's made this sort of meme of like Goodison Park, and it just says over the top, "No titles here, red shite." And I thought, yeah, how accurate, because you haven't won one since 1987, boys. So, yeah, there's definitely no titles at Goodison Park. There's a cuckoo clock, though. But, yeah, this game, Rob, Everton are winless in 18 Premier League games with Liverpool now. Drawn 10, lost 8 since a 2-0 win at Goodison in October 2010, which, of course, was a time when we were managed by Roy Hodgson. So that, for me, doesn't count. We are unbeaten against Everton in 21 games in all competitions. 6 of the last 7, though, have been draws at Goodison. So how much do you think it's going to take away from, you know, Everton's armoury, really, that they haven't got the rabid support that they enjoy when it's a derby?
I hope it does. It should do. But whether that's... there's been a lot of... Anytime I've even discussed this fixture with fellow Liverpool fans, there's been I wasn't going to call it complacency, but an absolute not being able to even consider that we might not beat Everton. And I think that's a little bit nuts. I know we're fantastic, but Ancelotti's turned them around. They're not terrible. And as you say, we don't... 6 out of the last 7 at Goodison have been draws. We're not beating them on their place with something to spare. This is different. They don't have their fans, but that doesn't mean we get to cruise this. Of course, it's possible. We are a better football team than them. Without fans, maybe it's been discussed that the technical sides are prevailing, home advantage isn't counting. So maybe Mike needs the referee. So maybe all the portents are with us. But also, we're starting football having not played for 12 weeks. And it's not as though we're all just going to pick up where we left off. Mind you, where we left off wasn't exactly our peak either. Although we thought we played well against Atletico, but we weren't at our peak.
Four defeats in the last 6 games we played, Rob.
Yeah, so I think anyone... I mean, people go, oh, we're going to do it against Everton. We're going to do it against... If not, then we're going to do it against Palace. I'm not quite taking those things for granted by any stretch of the imagination. My money's still, funnily enough, on it happening when we're not playing, when Chelsea play City after we play Palace tail end of next week. I think it's next Thursday, a week today, actually. I think that's when it could happen. Or it might be that we have to try and get a hard-fought draw or something at the Etihad itself. So I don't know. I'm not pessimistic, but I think we're moving into the unknown slightly here. And also there's the stories about injuries. Mo Salah's a doubt, we think. We don't know. Andy Robbo also missed one of the warm-up games. Having said that, I think Liverpool are strong enough to beat Everton, whatever kind of side we put out, as we have seen in the recent past.
Yeah, Mel, we are obviously recording this on a Thursday, so you know news around teams is fairly thin on the ground at the moment. Rob mentioned Robertson here. He's been seen Salah in training since Salah. We still don't know as well. I mean, Melissa, what do you make of this game? Because Everton, you know, as said, they're 12th in the league, 45 points behind Liverpool in the league. They've won 10 games this season in the Premier League and Liverpool have won 27. But they are unbeaten in 7 at Goodison. Norwich, the last team to win there in November.
And although it was 3.5 months ago now, if you look back at the sort of recent results for Everton, a couple of defeats there in the last couple of games they played. They lost to Arsenal at Arsenal. They were tonked by Chelsea, and they gave Chelsea loads of space to exploit, which you think if they're given that to Liverpool, you can't see Liverpool not winning. They also drew with Man United at Goodison Park, and they were defeated at Watford. Oh, no, sorry, they won at Watford, and we were defeated at Watford. I was getting mixed up there. But they're terrible against Liverpool. This is the thing for me that I keep coming back to. You can talk them up a little bit, but you know, they lost 5-2 at Anfield in the league in December, 1-0 at Anfield in the FA Cup in January. In general, there seems to be a huge mental block for them around Liverpool. So how do you see this one going, Mel? What's your thoughts on it?
I think especially with derbies, the absence of a home crowd is a big disadvantage, because that is what sort of sets the tone, what gives players the encouragement, the enthusiasm, what creates that air of, you know, this is not a very fun place to be right now for the opposition team. In saying that, though, it could also be the fact that players might feel less apprehensive, less pressure without the fans there. There's always two sides. There are individuals that can be hugely motivated by a home crowd, and also individuals that wilt because the pressure or the expectation can be too excessive. It's weird to try and predict games in general, I think, when a restart happens, because we don't really know what condition players are in. We've obviously seen, you know, bits of compilation from friendly games that are happening behind closed doors at the clubs, but that's not a general marker. And I think there are a few elements that determine these kind of games, and the trend we can see from the Bundesliga as well and from La Liga now is that teams with the best conditioning tend to fare really well. And as we know, Liverpool are a very well-conditioned team. Teams that have the technical players, like I've already mentioned, because that's less reliant on, you know, atmosphere, and it's basically just generated off your ability on a football pitch. And the other things are, as we've seen with Bayern Munich, when you're able to control important elements of a game, so the start, just before half-time, final 10 minutes, 10 minutes just after half-time, those crucial periods, because your tempo and stuff is not going... I don't think I've seen any team so far play at a sustained, you know, really intense level yet. And I think in that regard as well, Liverpool have shown their ability to control games. I just wonder if we'll see Everton hampered or actually enhanced by the absence of a home crowd.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating, won't it, Ian? And you know, you look back at recent results, as I was saying before, obviously a 0-0 there in March, which March 2019, which those weirdos celebrated as though we lost the league there, and they're still going on about that. I mean, all the best with that one, lads. That is some gymnastics you're doing there to reach that conclusion. Before that, another 0-0 April 2018. The 1-0 win, of course, 19th of December 2016. Sadio Mane, we'll never forget it. And then a series of draws before that. And then the only other win in recent times, it's not even recent times, October 2011, that's Suarez, Carroll, Rodwell getting sent off, and Kenny Dalglish's manager. So, you know, it's been tough to go there. And all the stuff that Mel's thought about there is going to be fascinating. You know, what pace will the game be played at? How will it affect Everton? How will it affect Liverpool? What will everyone's tactics be? You know, Everton did get torn apart by Chelsea. They left a big amount of space between the forwards and the midfield. Will Carlo Ancelotti have them more drilled now that he's had some time to work with them? You know, there's loads and loads of questions. And as Mel says, it's really hard to predict, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating, Dar, because obviously there is the Ancelotti factor, and we know how well he's done against us with Napoli the last couple of seasons. So yeah, we know what he can do. We know our manager he is. But also at the same time, if you look at the Bayern example, the fact that everybody in Germany is talking about the fact that home advantage is no longer an advantage, but Bayern are just winning things, so quality is coming through. We are a better team than Everton. I think that's just a given. I would expect to see this be the strongest team we put out against in this season, and we've beaten them twice already. So I think we're in a better place than them. I think they've come back with more injuries than we have. I think they've lost Yerry Mina from the start, and obviously Kabarman, who was going to be the lad who was going to run the midfield, he came back from his injury and broke down with a long-term injury again. So they're not really in a good place. They weren't playing brilliantly. And I would say, you know, the idea that we were on a poor run of form before the break isn't necessarily as accurate as everybody thinks, because, you know, the FA Cup game against Chelsea, there's a slightly diminished team. Atletico away is one of those you could expect to lose. Watford's a stinker, obviously. But the Atletico home game, it's one of the great European performances until Adrian throws the ball to an Atletico lad. Until that point, that's one of the best performances we've played all season. It was a brilliant game of football. So I think we are playing better than people would necessarily give us credit for. And if our legs were tied at that point, we've now had 3 months to get our legs a bit more fresh, get the players who need a rest, a bit of a rest. Obviously, Everton have got the same thing, and Ancelotti will have had some time on the training ground. I think we prepared for this brilliantly. I think I couldn't swear to it, but looking at the path, I'm not seeing every other team's path, but we appear to have been one of the first teams to have decided to have training on our own ground in front of an empty stadium. The 11 versus 11 internal game was a great idea. And then the friendly against Blackburn was a fantastic idea. So I think we prepared for this absolutely perfectly. Obviously, Salah might be an issue. I know there are doubts around Ronaldo at the moment as well in terms of his fitness, but we've got enough to cope for that. And the fact that it's always been hard going there, maybe because you know, legendarily Goodison is a compact ground, the crowd are on top of you, they are begging for blood. Without that, that might make a difference. And just the actual technique, I think we'll win through.
Rob, I mentioned some of the Evertonians' mental gymnastics that they do, and they bless them, some of the stuff that they produce and put out there. I mean, you know, there was stuff kicking around last night from, let's just say, some key Evertonian, shall we, about, you know, how this wasn't football and this wasn't right and this isn't, you know, it's not sporting integrity or, you know, all the classics, all the hits. And yet, you know, this sequence is their longest without a win in Merseyside derby history. Like, I obviously don't expect Everton to win, but I'm almost... I think it'd be hilarious. There's a scenario to say it'd be hilarious if they did, because what would you say? You didn't want football. You didn't want football played, lads. You said there was no sport and integrity. So are we saying this one doesn't count?
The nature of human beings when they're being hypocrites is that they'll actually exalt the victory goes, because see, with everything against us and it not counting and us not being motivated, we still were able to beat them. So in a funny sort of way, it counts more. Honestly, just. That is just the nature of people. They go, so, whenever you think you've turned them around, people will turn it around on you. It's. I couldn't get. I mean, you know what? Whatever happens, we will win this league, and our revenge will be sweet. Our revenge was sweet in Madrid for the celebrations that took place at Goodison last year when they held us to a draw, and I mean, as if they'd won a trophy. And the celebrations that they had in the pubs and clubs around their ground when we lost to Real Madrid the year before. We've won the European Cup, and that must have really, really hurt them. And we're going to win the league and be one of the greatest league title-winning sides of all time. It's just going to be a fact now, boys. Football's restarted. Liverpool will get it over the line. And all the record books will show is that Liverpool won the league this year by a mighty margin.
Absolutely, Rob. I think that's the key thing to end the show on, really, that we've got to all remember what a fantastic Liverpool side we are watching. It's played 29, won 27, drawn 1, lost 1 in the league. We are on 82 points. We are 22 points clear. There's a possible 109 points that Liverpool could put on the board this season. When they were 25 points clear before City won, that was the biggest lead in the top flight ever. And then, you know, you look back at last season as well, played 38, won 30, drawn 7, lost 1, 97 points, the best defence with only 22 goals conceded. And across 67 Premier League games, we've lost 2, which is phenomenal. I want to just end on a prediction, just because it seems like so long since we were able to even do this. So let's do it. Mel, what is your prediction for the scoreline in this game?
2-0
Liverpool. 2-0?
Yeah, okay. I say 2-0 as well to Liverpool.
And Ian?
Full house of 2-0s.
Okay, I am going 6-0 to Liverpool. That has been the weekend. Let's batter the Blues. Let's enjoy it. Let's get in the park with a Peroni and say up the Reds, because we've battered the Blues. We've hit them for 6. It's my birthday. Do it for me. Do it for the Reds. Do it for the world. Up the fucking Reds.
Thank you for listening to the Anfield Wrap. Listen, you're probably going to get bored of this over the next few weeks. We're putting this at the end of every show. It's Neil Atkinson here, whether I hosted this show or not, to ask you to vote for us in the British Podcast Awards. To do that, you go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote, and there you'll find it is the Listener's Choice Award, supported by BBC Sounds. If you search for the Anfield Wrap in the box that comes up, you will get the Anfield Wrap, or TAW also gets us the Anfield Wrap as well. So TAW gets us the Anfield Wrap, or the Anfield Wrap in there. And then from there, if you vote for us, you'll then get an email that you'll have to click to confirm the vote. And then from there, you've registered the vote, and we appreciate it very much. We've never won this award in the British Podcast Award. We've come second 3 consecutive years. We discovered that last season we were a little bit closer than we thought last year. Good Lord, not everything works like that, Neil. And so we thought, well, let's give it a real go. We'll give it a big push this time out. So hopefully you've been able to do that for us, and hopefully you're happy to do so as well. We do always appreciate the support in any way in which it comes at the Anfield Wrap, and especially through what's obviously been a difficult time for a number of podcasts for obvious reasons. Anyway, thank you very much indeed, and take care. Sports Social Podcast Network.